plenty of people listen to my story. A little story about a man named Jed.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented to UHF. Watching it with me is Paul Abbott from Hark, the 87th Precinct podcast. Hi, Paul, how are you?
I'm fine, it's lovely to be back.
Welcome back. This is a bit of a change. Obviously, your previous visit was for Transformers the movie, and this is one that we discussed as well quite a long time ago. What's so special about UHF for you?
I came to this film quite late, well, in terms of when it came out. Obviously, it came out towards the end of the 80s. Didn't come out on DVD, I don't think, till into the 2000s. And when I finally got round to it, it was when I just really got into Weird Al as a musician. For years, I think with Weird Al, it's easy to sort of feel a bit snotty about him because he is out and out silly. You know, just daft, madcap, zany, all the words that when you think you're a bit cool, you're sort of like, shy away from. But eventually, I just got it. And then finally I saw this film and it's just joy for me all the way through. It is 97 minutes of just daftness.
Oh, this was one of those films that I guess, you know, this isn't as famous as many of the other podcasts or films that I've done. And I think, you know, I can't remember ever talking about it to many people. I remember this was one of the ones that I've discussed this before about how we used to have a guy coming around like a mobile video library in the back of his van, which sounds quite dodgy when you talk about it now. And he'd have all these videos. And for, I'm not sure why we came across this one, but me and my brother watched it. And I mean, we must have been, I don't know, 11. Well, I'd have been, I guess, 11 or 12 when I saw it. And to 11 or 12-year-old me, it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And all I knew about Weird Al Yankovic before was a couple of the music videos I'd seen of, I think, Eat It and Like a Surgeon, I think, were the only ones seen. And again, that just goes to show, sort of, when you say outright silly, that's where we are. But I'll be honest, when you suggested doing this episode, I've been looking forward to it for ages, and getting the chance to sit down as an adult and watch this for the first time in years, a lot of it still holds up, do you think?
It does, yeah. And it perhaps would have had a wider sort of audience if a whole set of circumstances hadn't occurred in terms of the films that were out around the time that this came out, and a load of stuff going on with the distributors, Arai, and things like that. So more people might have heard of it, and it should have been a bigger hit. But as it is, it's just Weird Al doing what Weird Al does best, which is putting like 110% of energy into everything he does, and doing it quite skillfully, and the craft is sort of hidden away behind the silliness, but it's amazingly well crafted, like all his songs are. So it deserves to be seen.
I mean, for someone who not meaning it to sound too cruel, but he's got famous and made a living off making a lot of music which are parodies of existing songs.
Yes, indeed.
So of course this film has some quite significant tentpole scenes that are parodies of other films.
Yeah.
And the fact that this opens with a parody of Raiders of the Lost Ark, with some visual gags that, you know, wouldn't look out of place in, you know, The Naked Gun or something like that. You know, that's the kind of level we are. And this, you know, played on it as well. I think this came out around a similar time as Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So
it did, yeah.
Just watching it the other night, and you kind of, it opens on the Raiders, and you just kind of go, oh God, here we go. And because you know, you remember most of it, and it is just pure outright silly but funny.
Yeah, like within 2 minutes of the film starting, he's whipped the gun out of someone's hand, but he's actually ripped their entire arm off. And it's just, it goes, just that's a small sample of how silly it's going to be. But the funny thing with the opening with that Raiders parody is, of course, like you mentioned, like The Last Crusade, that was one of those massive films that opened that year, that this came out and basically shut down any space in the box office for films like this to get through. And there were so many massive films that year.
Yeah, I mean, that summer, and you've got Last Crusade, Batman, License to Kill.
Yeah.
I think there was a Lethal Weapon 2 that year as well.
Lethal Weapon 2, When Harry Met Sally, even things like Turner and Hooch and Parenthood, which were fairly successful films. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was an absolute smash. And the one I found that was comparable in in fact worse performing than UHF was Great Balls of Fire, the biopic about Jerry Lee Lewis.
Is that the Dennis Quaid one, was it?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. So that was made by Orion as well as UHF, and that one actually lost money. UHF at least made a little bit of money.
Yeah, and it's got this cult following. I mean, I couldn't even remember. I think the last time I heard of Great Balls of Fire was someone put a picture on Twitter going, can anyone remember this film? And I was like, barely. I never saw it. But, yeah, and again, this film, I always, you know, one of those, you always think, did I remember it? You know, no one else seems to have seen it. But I think I've had the upper hand with that one. I think, you know, they've missed out.
Definitely. Definitely. I do feel for him because I believe they were sort of ramping him up to be a big hit and they thought it was going to be, and it tested really well with audiences, and then it just couldn't find a place in the market and it was dead in a week, essentially.
It's sad. I think, again, that's probably quite a common thing, especially back then when you had, you know, I suppose a star in some regards. I mean, it's hard to say, he wasn't a massive name in the UK. But
no,
you get the feeling, and he's one of those. He's had cameos in various films and things like that. But I think a lot of people might recognise him if they saw him, for example. But you know, for this to be, you know, his big film and for it to fall down, and I'm sure Orion pop up on several of these. It sounds awful, but they're almost like a, you know, a canon movie, sort of sibling, aren't they?
Yeah, and basically after the 1989 and these couple of flops, they were basically bankrupt afterwards. So they were, I don't know if the films were the kiss of death or Orion was the kiss of death for the films. Probably a little of both.
And again, just to give you any sort of indication, if you come into this film thinking it's a serious Raiders of the Lost Ark tribute, the fact that when he gets into the main sort of antechamber and finds instead of an idol, it's an Oscar. It's just
not an official Oscar though, because they weren't legally allowed to use it. So it's the design's changed. So it's got his hands covering its crotch. that's how they got around the trademark shape.
Yeah, but yeah, again, like some of the booby trap scenes in that, you know, the proper green screen stuff where the boulders chasing him across the Sphinx and into snow, and yeah.
And that's your opening. It's nuts.
And just to show, he wakes up because this is all one big daydream. As we find out, this is his thing. He's a daydreamer, and he's working at a burger chain. That I guess is one of these things where he's portrayed as a serial loser. This is what, his fourth or fifth job in a month.
Yeah, and he just can't help himself drifting off into these cinematic dreamscapes, which always clearly keeps snapping out of and getting fired straight away, which is what happens after we've had this first sequence. He's flung out of Big Edna's Burgers.
And him and his hapless mate Bob, who just sort of going along for the ride and just getting dragged along with him. Poor fella.
Yeah, and he doesn't actually, the character of Bob in the film is interesting. I'm not entirely sure why he's in there, because he doesn't really get masses to do in the rest of the film, other than, you know, come on the bad end of a couple of George is the character Weird Al plays, George's decisions. So poor old Bob.
I suppose he's kind of the straight man, really, but he does get put upon an awful lot.
He just gets smashed in the face with a frying pan. So.
Yeah, it's Vic and Bob-esque, but slightly different levels. One thing I'd forgotten about, and this almost made me go to the kitchen, was after this, when they go back to their apartment, and this is they're living next door to the is it Cooney's Kung Fu School?
Yes, they are.
And they makes a hot dog out of a Twinkie.
Oh. Yeah, a Twinkie split in half with a hot dog wiener in the middle with Cheese Whiz on top, which he then dunks into a cup of milk.
Yeah, I think they had me until the milk, but that looks like a decadent treat. I've read on one of the IMDb trivia things that was one of, he cited that as a reason why he took up vegetarianism.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. If you had to do several takes of that, I think as a one-off you'd be tempted to try that, but yeah, if you have to do it several times for the cameras, that would probably turn you.
He's got a girlfriend, Terry goes to her house and Close Encounters style makes a big mountain out of mashed potato.
Yeah, never explained particularly, other than it's perhaps a symbol of something to come. But yeah,
yeah,
He goes from, because he's always, we get the impression that he's always letting Terry down because he's such a daydreamer. And when he gets there, his apologies are suddenly put aside when he realises she's made lots of mash for him.
I guess you have to have seen Close Encounters to have got that one.
Yeah, but it's one of just many, many sort of nods and tributes, because there's obviously the literal where they've remade, they've made a parody of something, but there's lots and lots of nods to cinema in this. And I think it all comes off the back of Weird Al's growing up and his love of popular culture and TV and film. So I think that's seeded all the way through it.
This is like, I suppose, a real-life episode of Family Guy, except without a lot of the bad, awful,
yes,
he's a wanker sort of thing taken out. So
yeah. It's, yeah, in terms of the language in the film, actually, just thinking about it, because I think it's like PG-13, you know, the American rating.
Mm.
But he had to sort of negotiate a few of the things. He left stuff in that could have got him a lower rating if he'd have taken it out. But some of the language and the references in it are quite strident, and I'm sure they'll crop up as we talk through it.
And we find that he goes to a party with his aunt and uncle. His uncle's a gambler, which, luckily enough, comes out later on as well. His uncle's doing quite well at playing cards and wins a TV channel, which I suppose is, if you're in that circle, it's the sort of thing you'd bet. I guess now with the plethora of Sky Virgin channels you can get, it's probably quite easy if you win a random movie channel or something with rights to, I know, old episodes of Street Hawk or something.
I don't know, it's like someone's betting Talking Pictures TV because they've run because they've lost their watch.
God, I mean, that wouldn't be a bad thing. I know that channel gets a bit of love on here because they show quite a lot of handy 80s music movies, which come in quite handy. But
it's brilliant, yeah, Talking Pictures. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, if someone's, I mean, it's been quite a while since I played any card game other than Snap, but it'd be quite nice to win something like that. But winning a very ineffective cable TV channel, I suppose George's aunt feels sorry for him and decides to say, oh, I know who'll run that for you. It's a job.
So he's, it's a sort of thing that, you know, she gives it to George as a way to just give him something to do because he turned up at this party all despondent because he's lost his, you know, lost another job. And so he's got this, he has to go to this essentially barn on the outskirts of town, which is this UHF TV station, where he goes there with his girlfriend Terry and meets this engineer character called Philo.
What an odd character.
Very odd. Yeah. And gets odder as things go along.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if it gives you any indication of what sort of person George is like, as his aunt and uncle decide to give him the job, he's feeding a bowl of punch to a Jack Russell. So.
Yeah, which he then drops into the bowl of punch when he's done with it.
And someone else we meet at the station is the secretary, and it's Pamela. There's Fran Drescher, who's popped up on here previously on This Is Spinal Tap, but she's very distinctive, I think it's one way of putting it.
It is, but I think she's really good. I wish her part in this film was a bit bigger, but I think she's a joy when she's on screen. She's just got such a great presence, and she fits into this world as she's there sort of working like a secretary, but she's supposed to be a news broadcaster. And so George, being the nice guy he is, she's instantly becomes their news anchor, and she's out and about. So, and she's just that laugh and that silly little the looks to camera she gives are brilliant.
I suppose if you're in that sort of industry, if you're sort of hand to mouth and everything like that, then people might have to double up anyway. But yeah, it's not a bad little start.
No, indeed. And she's got her little sidekick, who's the diminutive cameraman Noodles.
Yes, he's was that Billy Barty? Nice to see him.
Yes.
Popping up again after Master of the Universe.
Master of the Universe, yeah.
Oh, Gwildor. How we miss him. Now, we get our first advert. Now, these will pop up throughout as George kind of realises what sort of things they're selling on his TV stand. It's Crazy Eddie's.
Howdy, friends. It's Crazy Ernie from Crazy Ernie's Used Car Emporium. It's a giant supermarket of cars! I got so many cars, people come up to me and say, "Hey, Crazy Ernie, where'd you get all those cars? Looky here, I got red cars, I got green cars, I got enough cars to choke a camel!" Tell you what, friends, if nobody comes down and buys a car for me in the next hour, I'm gonna club this baby seal! That's right! I'm gonna club his seal to make a better deal!
Imagine, I think another thing I saw was that Crispin Glover, who played George in Back to the Future, wanted to play that role, and it would have been a very different interpretation.
Yeah, apparently he came in and he was offered another role in it, and he was like, "No, I just want to play Crazy Eddie," who's like in for one scene for an advert. He was probably just thinking quick paycheck or something like that. And they were just like, "Well, no, you're not right for that." So there you go, you missed out, Crispin.
I mean, we did get some good adverts throughout that, and that was a nice little stray in. But every movie needs a villain, shall we say. And shortly after, we meet R.J. Fletcher, the head of the local network, and immediately sets the tone. He's no nice guy.
He is absolutely horrible, pantomime, nasty guy. His first thing we see is he fires the janitor for no good reason. But he's played by Kevin McCarthy, who was 75 when he made this, which is incredible. He was the original lead in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's like he's phenomenal in this. He just plays it so... He's so smug and so evil. R.J. Fletcher is just... He's the perfect foil for someone as nice and kind as Weird Al's George.
Yeah, it really chews up the scenery whenever he's on.
Yeah.
And yeah, his first real role is he fires the janitor Stanley, who becomes this, I suppose, the beacon, the great white hope for George. But this is Michael Richards pre-Seinfeld. So
yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, his career took a nosedive at one point, didn't it? But yes.
Yeah, he's a funny one, Michael Richards. I mean, obviously, he's literally funny in this. Mm. Seinfeld, obviously, was the making of him. But apparently, he was so into like yoga and meditation and focus and concentration that his presence on set was a bit weird. And he was stick thin, like really, really, really thin from dieting. So he must have been a very odd man to be around. But he plays this childlike janitor who gets sacked at in his first scene, and then
Kramer-esque, I suppose, in a weird way, but without the eccentricities. He's just I think the word simpleton is probably a bit cruel, but he's definitely maybe childlike is a nice
childlike, I think I'd go with.
And he has his precious mop stolen, and this almost reminded me of, like, the Trigger broom thing. He said he was given that mop when he was a kid, and as he's kicked out, the goon takes the mop back off him, and he kind of feel like, well, is that eternal question, is it still the same mop?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it is, it's Chekhov's mop, because we've seen it at the start of the film. It's got to come back later.
Yeah. And of course George takes pity on him and hires him for his new station. Now we're starting to see a lot more material about what's coming on U62, George's station. We see Emo Phillips on Town Talk.
I love Emo Phillips.
The distinctive Emo Phillips.
Yes, very much so.
Doing some DIY poorly.
Yeah, so he comes in as the local high school teacher who's brought in like a table saw. And to demonstrate on George's segment called Town Talk, which starts off as very dour and a bit sort of like, oh, local celebrities. And I'm sure there's plenty of stations in America that were like that at some point, you know, get someone in there. But yeah, Emo Phillips demonstrating the table saw and chopping his thumb off and just blood going everywhere.
It's the sort of thing they used to parody on The Fast Show, so you kind of think that this had been going on for years anyway, but... yeah, I think that was one of the things I saw that they kind of had alternative versions of. But I think it just seemed to work so well. I mean, it was a small role and it just sort of sets the tone. You know, this is a DIY show, and yes, accidents can and invariably will happen.
Yeah, it's is my face red?
See, that tickled me more than it should have done. But
Spatula? Okay, kids, let's go.
There's just one place to go for all your spatula needs.
Spatula City!
Spatula City!
A giant warehouse of spatulas for every occasion. Thousands to choose from in every shape, size, and color. And because we eliminate the middleman, we can sell all our spatulas factory direct to you. Where do you go when you want to buy name brand spatulas at a fraction of retail cost?
Spatula City!
Spatula City!
And this weekend only, take advantage of our special liquidation sale. Buy 9 spatulas, get the 10th one for just 1 penny. Don't forget, they make great Christmas presents. And what better way to say I love you than with the gift of a spatula?
Spatula City!
Spatula City!
Hello, this is Cy Greenbloom, president of Spatula City. I like their spatulas so much, I bought the company.
Spatula City, 7 locations. We're in the yellow pages under spatulas.
My, where did you get that lovely spatula?
Spatula City, we sell spatulas, and that's all.
Probably my favourite, and a lot of people's favourite advert, Spatula City. Of all the things you can imagine that would sell on local TV, a warehouse exclusively for spatulas with its distinctive jingle.
Spatula City is a brilliant conceit in the film because it is such a good advert, because it's so like something you would see, but it's for spatulas, and this notion that anyone would be that obsessed with spatulas that they would take the entire family out for a day out spatula shopping. But it's one of Weird Al's themes that crops up again and again. Like when he did his own TV show for kids in the mid-90s, one of the things in the opening credits for that is about him meeting a dental nurse with a spatula tattooed on her arm. And George's girl in this is a dentist.
True,
His girl, that sounds like some sort of 50s rocker. George's girlfriend is a dentist and a spatula. So, yeah, a Weird Al, for some reason, loves spatulas. And, you know, why not?
They had the owner who clearly badly reading off the auto cue, saying he loved it so much he bought the company. Which, was that Remington, I think it was? So
yeah, something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those old ones I remember vaguely. Something about whether it's vacuum cleaners or some household appliance. But yeah, that was something I always remember weirdly, just from that film. So, and every time you see one now, you know, set of spatulas or something like that, you just think of that in your head.
I know. Yeah, it's also brilliant because apparently they put up the big roadside sign that they use in it to indicate turn off here to see Spatula City, and they left that up after they'd filmed, and so there's people turning off to go to this place that didn't exist.
But that was some sort of weird theme park.
Yeah, all these confused people outside Tulsa where they filmed it, just looking for spatulas.
It sounds weird to call it the anchor show, but that's what it becomes. Uncle Nutsy's Funhouse, which sounds like something like prison lingo, really. But it's a kid's TV show that George is Uncle Nutsy and Bob is it Bobbo?
Bobbo the Clown.
Bobbo the Clown is Stooge. And it's just, it's as ridiculous as you kind of, it's like Krusty the Clown Show, but not as funny and certainly not as popular at this point anyway.
Yeah, I think it's quite clever because I think the implication here is George has gone, well, we need original programming to enhance this. I'm going to just do it all myself. And he's actually not that good at it. So he goes in as Uncle Nutsy and he dresses Bob up as the clown, hits him with the frying pan, which apparently in real life he hit him quite hard and he was bleeding under his makeup. So they only did one take, that one. But yeah, and there's also all these bored kids, about 5 or 6 bored kids watching him, one of whom spits in his face.
Kids today, oh wait, kids of the late 80s, I don't know, yeah. Shocking.
That's a hate crime now.
Yeah, I suppose he's probably just looking after himself. If someone called Uncle Nutsy comes up to you and asks for your name, you're going to spit in your face to create some distance.
But this is the point at which, because George is doing so much stuff, he's again missed a date with Terry for her birthday with her family, and so he's basically, the relationship's more or less over by this point as well. So we've got a crap station with crap programs with no money, his girlfriend's leaving him, and he's not in a great place after the first third of the film.
No, he's kind of falling asleep to a Plots R Us advert and dreaming of the Beverly Hillbillies and I suppose he must have had permission, because I think Mark Knopfler played on it, didn't he? Money for Nothing.
Well, that's one of Weird Al's skills, is he's really good at parodying the music that he parodies. He uses the same band than he has done for a long, long, long time. But also the American copyright system's funny in that you don't have to pay for the rights if you're parodying something.
Okay.
You can just do it. It's permitted under the copyright law in America, at least. But Al always asks permission. You know, politeness, really, because he knows he's sending these people up, and apparently most people say yes. And Mark Knopfler said yes, and can I play the guitar on it as well?
That's not a bad thing. I mean, it's like the old thing, the opposite of ask for forgiveness, because it's easier than asking permission. But, I mean, he's had such a catalogue of these songs. I mean, everything from, you know, the Michael Jackson ones in the 80s. And I mean, and I guess he must have had permission from George Lucas, because he did one of American Pie for the... Was it the Phantom Menace, the Star Wars one that came
out?
Yeah,
he did that as well. Yeah, and obviously, usually in his videos, all of which are directed by the guy who directed this, who's his friend and his manager, and directs all his videos. Yeah, they're all very direct parodies of the actual videos or the situation, so there's a lot of using of the stuff from the real world, but he does it so well. I think you'd definitely be proud if Weird Al wanted to parody one of your songs. You'd be a very churlish person to say no.
You know you've made it if that's the case.
Yeah, definitely.
One thing you touched on there, and you know, this is something I noticed when you mentioned about the director, and it's Jay Levy, and I kind of thought, okay, well, what else has he done? And it's literally his CV is working with Weird Al. That's pretty much all he's done. I mean, this guy, he's not going to pop up and going, oh, he directed that, did he? And one of those random things. Well, he directed Weird Al stuff, and that's about it.
Yeah, they're just pals who have worked together forever, and that was clearly part of the leverage of making this film, as well. He's going to direct it. He's done everything else, so. And someone gave him the money and let them go with it. So
it's a shame that Orion went bust. They'd be making some fantastic stuff if they were still going. It's probably the same as Canon.
Yeah.
After, as you said, George gets dumped by Terry for forgetting her birthday, he turns up and does an Uncle Nutsy show, and it all goes really wrong, and Stanley takes over halfway through. And as he goes to drown his sorrows in a local bar, everyone is watching Stanley do well on this clubhouse show in the bar, and it becomes, I guess, one of those like a overnight sensation. It's suddenly the best thing in town. Amazingly,
that's not even an overnight sensation. It's in the time it takes him to walk from the UHF station to the bar. Stanley Spadowski is the biggest hit in town. My main thing I like about that sequence, though, is just before they leave to go for a drink, Bob says to him, "But you don't drink," and he says, "Well, I might start now." And he gets there, and first thing he orders himself to start drinking is a blueberry daiquiri.
I think, I don't know, I mean, I can't remember ever being in a bar or pub and kids' TV being on, but I suppose if, you know, someone in there must have flicked on the wrong channel or something and seen Michael Richards do some weird stuff involving a fire hose, and because that'd sell most things, probably.
Yeah, and so that instantly is an instant hit, and that leads to loads more original programs with other people from the community. So Cooney from the Kung Fu school is drafted in to present Wheel of Fish.
It's exactly as silly as it sounds, and yes, it's basically Wheel of Fortune with fish. So
yeah,
I can't imagine these ideas took a long time to come up with, but they're executed well, and Cooney's quite a distinctive character. Calling everyone stupid.
Yeah. I mean, you probably wouldn't put that sort of character in now, because it's very much this peculiar East Asian character. And it's not stereotyping by any means, but it's there's something perhaps wouldn't get away with now. Or maybe you would. Maybe it'd be more of an ownership thing. I don't know. But he is brilliant. He's very funny. And you also then get Trinidad Silver as Raoul's Wild Kingdoms presenter, which is one of the most... I mean, you wouldn't put this sequence in today, because even though it would all be done with effects, and obviously it was then as well, but he's basically flinging animals out of the window and sticking them on the ceiling, and it's nuts.
If you ever wondered if a tortoise could be a suction cup or if a poodle can fly, then... yeah, this is your... It's kind of... I mean, the weird thing is this... it reminded me of the Ace Ventura, but if he turned, I won't say evil, but instead of helping the animals, he was using them for his own weird scientific experiments.
Yeah, and that's a nice little sequence that you think is going to come back, but sadly Trinidad Silva died during the making of this. I know him mainly because he was in quite a lot of Hill Street Blues. He was very good in that, and but in this he's just some mad guy who's got all these pets in his apartment and likes to fling them out the window.
Yeah, there is a good scene shortly afterwards where he's taking delivery of some new animals. Don't take no stinking badgers.
Yes, it's a great misquote of the Treasure of Sierra Madre that you just don't expect in the middle of this madcap film.
And we go back in Stanley Spadowski's funhouse. Is the hot big show. We've got the kid drinking from the fire hose as a reward for finding stuff in a big vat of oatmeal.
Yeah.
God. I suppose if you're a 8 or 9 year old kid, it'd probably be quite fun for the first half a second. It takes your skin off.
I think it turns into this Pee-wee's Playhouse type thing. Which I've never seen Pee-wee's Playhouse, but it's obviously a massive influence on quite a lot of people, including I think Weird Al. And I found out that the cinematographer for this, David Lewis, actually was the cinematographer, camera operator for Pee-wee's Playhouse. That's probably one of the reasons I'm brought in to do this. He did Pee-wee's Playhouse, the films Leprechaun 3 and Leprechaun 4 in space, and Children of the Corn 5.
A true connoisseur.
Yeah, of all those videos you'd see in the video shop, you'd be looking at going, Children of the Corn 5.
God, I didn't know there was a second, third or fourth one. Bloody hell.
Well, you've got something to research now.
Yeah. Now, in the meantime, he wins back Terry by essentially filling her flat with hearts and flowers and, well, not real hearts. But I guess she just falls for it. It makes it sound simple. But, yeah, all is forgiven. And
yeah, a grand romantic gesture.
Yeah. And as part of the original programming, we get a trailer for the much-loved Conan the Librarian. What a scene.
Never before in the history of motion pictures has there been a screen presence so commanding, so powerful, so deadly. He's Conan the Librarian.
Can you tell me where I can find a book on astronomy?
Don't you know the Dewey Decimal System?
Conan the Librarian.
I'm sorry, these books are a little overdue.
Conan the Librarian.
Absolutely brilliant. With the line, don't you know the Dewey Decimal System? It's exactly, well, again, like much of this, it's exactly as you imagine it would be from just hearing the name of it.
I guess that's something where you could just, well, there's a couple more to come as well, but it's just like, if, you know, in the way that they make porno films based on the title of a successful Hollywood film, this is just it, except without the boobs. So
yes, more or less.
How can we make this silly?
Yeah, and then not long after that, though, he's filling up the schedule. He's got like a sticky board where he's putting all the new programs and films and things that are on. And I paused it and took a screen grab of that to see what was on it.
Go on, it so is enormous.
Well, we've got the Strands for News, obviously. You've got Every Day as Stanley Spadowski's Clubhouse, obviously. George's program, Town Talk, is now a late night talk show. But you've got things in there like Wheel of Fish, yeah. Leave It to Bigfoot. Name That Stain, The Wonderful World of Phlegm, Underwater Bingo for Teens, a show that's just called That's Disgusting, one called The Lice is Right, one called The Flying Pope, and Bestiality Today.
I never noticed that one.
So yeah, they've got it all on UHF.
No wonder this is the number one station in town.
Yeah, as they find out whilst he's doing this board, they discover they've become the number. They've outstripped the network affiliate. So that's where the conflict comes with R.J. Fletcher in the next bit of the film.
I guess this is the sort of channel that and again would maybe flourish in a social media environment where people mm-hmm. talk about it, and you've got half the people would watch it and they would be outraged, and half the people, and I'd probably be in this half, who'd watch it go, bowling for burgers, strip solitaire, you know, sign me up.
Yeah, celebrity mud wrestling with Mikhail Gorbachev.
God, how did they sign him up for that? God.
I don't know. We must have been very busy at the time with the fall of the Berlin Wall and all that stuff going on.
I wonder if the actor they used for that advert was the same person who played Gorbachev in The Naked Gun, or the Gorbachev-esque in Rocky IV.
Oh, yeah, possibly. Yeah, he might have been. He might have been Hollywood's top Gorby impersonator.
He's like that woman who always played the Queen.
Yes, yeah.
So it turns out that Uncle has lost on the horses and owes 75 grand to the mysterious Mr. Big Louie.
Big Louie.
Call him Mr. Big.
Who's got a fake hand that you can replace with a meat cleaver. So it's like a bit like the baddie in Inspector Gadget. You just see his arm and the edge of the chair and this sort of attachment to his hand.
Pure villain.
Yeah.
And he agrees to sell the ownership of Channel 62 to R.J. Fletcher because, as I say, R.J. Fletcher is aggrieved that he's lost his number one status. I'll chuck this in. There was a glorious advert for the late night version of Town Talk, which, I guess it was apparently based on the Geraldo show?
Yeah, something like that. It's the sort of thing that led eventually to Jerry Springer and those sorts of shows.
Yeah, because I mean, they had a scene where it had devils and Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members fighting on a stage, and he gets a chair in the face.
Well, this is what I mean about it, you know, being a PG-13 and then worrying about some of the cartoon violence. But then he does have a section where you've got a Nazi, a girl in bondage gear, a KKK member, a Girl Scout and Jason Voorhees all together. So you've got like a Klansman on, and his next program he's announcing is lesbian Nazi hookers abducted by UFOs and forced into weight loss programs.
And I guess one of the things he talked about was sex with furniture, but then it's on Jerry Springer, that was kind of the norm, wasn't it? Was it the man who married a horse?
Yeah, that sort of thing. I like the bit where one of his big exposés is that he discovers what's in Al Capone's glove compartment. It turns out the answer is roadmaps.
Oh, if only we knew. It's like JFK all over again. So George is aware that he needs to raise $75,000. And I guess all you can do to raise that much money if you're in a TV station of that era is to have a telephone.
Yeah.
I suppose like, hey, sport relief, hey, children need, hey. We see a couple of clips of some of the entertainment they put on for this, and it's rubbish.
Yeah, the only person that anyone's interested in is Stanley Spadowski. So all the acts that go on otherwise, which I believe were all actual acts that went out and did this stuff, like these weirdos called the Kipper Kids and this guy who does yodeling upside down and all that stuff, they're actual people whose act that was their act.
God, I suppose it wouldn't be expensive to hire them.
Well, possibly not.
I always remember the yodeling guy for some reason. That was something that always stuck in my head ever since I watched it the first time. But I hear yodeling and I think of that upside down fella. But there's an advert for the upcoming movie, which is probably my favourite of the parodies he does. There's Gandhi 2.
He's back. And this time, he's mad. Gandhi 2. No more Mr. Passive Resistance. He's out to kick some butt. This is one bad mother you don't want to mess with.
Don't move, lame boy.
He's a one-man wrecking crew. But he also knows how to party.
Give me a steak, medium rare.
Hey, Baldy!
There is only one law. His law. Gandhi 2.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is essentially Shaft.
I wouldn't say, I don't think sacrilegious is the word, but it's sort of sacrilegious. But I think given the Gandhi being such a massive film, it's such an easy target to have Gandhi too. He fights hard and he plays hard as well.
And the fact that the music in the background is virtually the theme to Shaft anyway. So.
Yeah. But that's happening after Stanley Spadowski's been kidnapped by the goons sent by R.J. Fletcher.
Yeah, one of them turned out, because he's one of these sort of stereotypical Italian-American actors who actually turned out to be quite a sort of recurring character in The Sopranos. Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? His low-level stuff is kidnap the janitor of the local TV station.
Yeah, well, that lead thug looks more like Al Pacino in Scarface than Al Pacino looks like Al Pacino in Scarface. He's got this amazing sort of twitch, this nervous twitch.
As we've got all this, Philo has installed some spy cameras into RJ's office. I'll just mention quickly, because this is important later, RJ gives Tramp some change.
He does. He's very, very dismissive of him. Very dismissive of him. Only gives him a penny.
Well, just that might come in handy. Terry goes to see RJ to kind of to plead with him to go easy on George, but like not to buy the station. And of course, this is where he reveals his true colours. Unbeknownst to him, he's on full camera.
Yeah, he's basically dismissing the townspeople. He doesn't care what they think and all that sort of stuff. All the while, what George is doing is he's basically galvanising the town together by doing this telethon where he's selling shares in his TV station, so everyone feels they're getting a part of this. So it's this lovely, George is like building community, and you know the big network affiliate is just essentially pissing on them.
Is this like a Kickstarter sort of thing? Or a Patreon?
Yes, yeah, it's the 1989 equivalent.
Yeah, get on board early and see what you can get. But shares in a very weird TV station are probably the good one. I mean, something I was going to... I wrote in my notes here, and I made a joke to my wife about it, was this is almost like... this is almost becoming a bit meta, a podcast, talking about podcasting. But you always think about this could be a podcast now where a sort of weird upstart comes along and does quite well, and then the big guy, let's call him the BBC or something like that, come along and decide either we'll have some of that or we'll do exactly the same thing, but with our infinite resources.
Yes, I mean, I feel very strongly that DIY podcasting is the most important form of it. So the Johnny Come Latelys, who all turn out to be big corporations, are very annoying.
Yeah, and their adverts are for things like mattresses or beer subscriptions rather than Spatula City. But got to pay the bills somehow.
But I think that this is a good bit of this here is that Stanley Spadowski, being such a childlike soul, just doesn't care that he's sort of been kidnapped, and then it leads to the point where he rediscovers his mop from the start of the sequence of the film, rather, and that gives him sort of superpowers to get out of there. Almost,
it's his inspiration to sort of disarm them all. And I mean, we've got a really quite silly, I wouldn't even say a fight, but as they're trying to detain him, there's the firing a staple gun into the face of the goon behind him and things like that, and a token sort of 2 seconds of the lightsaber sound as he grabs his mop.
Yeah, and he more or less gets away, but not quite. And that's when we get the next really big film parody sequence, which is the Rambo dream sequence.
Oh, now, I mean, I can't remember if I'd seen this before I saw Rambo 2, which is what it rips off. But luckily, listeners to the podcast will know, because Rambo 2 was the episode that came out about 3 or 4 before this one. Having watched it again very recently, it's... you know, a very credible parody, and apparently Stallone did agree to do a cameo in it, but couldn't for some reason or another, which is a shame. That would have been priceless.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been amazing to see some photos of Stallone stood next to Weird Al in his mock-up bodysuit, muscle suit, doing his Stallone noise, which gets sillier and sillier as he's blowing up, world monuments.
and the bit I did mention actually when we did the Rambo 2 episode was the scene with the bow and arrow,
yeah,
where I mean it In Rambo 2, I mean, he was probably a couple of hundred yards away. In this, he was maybe 4 feet.
Yeah.
With his explosive arrow.
Good comedy reveal, that bit.
I mean, this was pre-Hot Shots Part 2 as well, so
they
got in there early with that one.
Yeah, but it masks the reality, which is George going to try and rescue Stanley, and he gets there, and so he's gone through all this, like, in his mind, he's fighting the forces, he's getting there, he's rescuing him, and he gets there, and he just gets a gun pointed in his face, and he's trapped as well.
Yeah, luckily Cooney's there to help them beat them all up in there. Yeah, luckily, it just happens he's a kung fu teacher and has his own pupils with him.
Yeah.
So they return to the cable station, sort of as returning heroes. It's all very, you know, it was still very tense because they've got a deadline and this. But as R.J. Fletcher is going to do it's almost like a party political broadcaster, Philo just happens to have some incriminating footage.
Yes, so the power of the UHF transmitter is put into use to intercept the signal and beam in the footage of R.J. Newman doing his rant about the townspeople being morons and the like. Actually, I must mention, just before I forget, the guy that plays one of the characters in this is R.J. Newman's son. Not R.J. Newman, R.J. whatever his name is.
Mm.
I'm getting all my names mixed up now. I'm getting excited. So you've basically got, R.J. Fletcher's son, and he just does the most bizarre appearances. He's like the news anchor or the news reporter for the big network station. And every time he's on screen, he's just got this weirdest sort of smug, silly cow nostrils face. And I love every time he comes on the screen. And so even though he doesn't really have much to do in the film, he's someone to keep an eye out for as well.
Yeah, he does seem like the sort of person they parodied in Anchorman.
Yeah.
A non-speaking extra in the background. So as they play this, RJ is suddenly the villain, and it just so happens that because they need a couple of $1,000 with seconds to spare, the tramp who'd been given the penny, it turns out to be in a very rare, lucky... I can't even remember how he described it, but...
It's a double... Oh, blimey, I wrote it down, but I don't know where I've put it. 1955 double die... something something something, but anyway, it's one of these pennies that was mispressed. I found it now. The penny was a 1955 double die Denver mint penny, which is worth thousands.
God, just what, how convenient. And he manages to buy the last remaining shares in the TV show and even shows off his new Rolex to RJ, who had previously bemoaned the fact that for his Father's Day present, he wasn't given a Rolex.
Yeah, his world crumbles. So not only does he not manage to secure the money to bulldoze the UHF station, he doesn't have his Rolex. He then also, a guy from the FCC turns up and tells him they're revoking his license. And a nice little old lady who was watching his speech on telly comes along and kicks him in the nuts.
Yeah, just for good measure. And that's pretty much it. It's a happy ending. There's this isn't an Avengers film. There's no setup for a sequel. There's no Samuel L. Jackson lurking in the background with an eye patch. It's all very nicely contained. And as we were talking about off air, I mean, this was, you know, a film that in an hour and a half, it has some, some of it is quite generic and quite low budget. Sounds an awful way of describing it, but that's exactly what it was in some regards. But I mean, the parody sequences, the dream sequences, and some of the visual gags in here are as good as some of those you get in any of the big comedy films of the time.
Yeah, it is. And it doesn't quite do what something like Airplane does, but it's of a similar DNA, I think. And they did discuss that they could perhaps make a film that was just like a load of sequences of parodies and things like that, or more sketchy type stuff, but they decided to try and put a story in it, which is, you know, it's a fairly lightweight story. But I will say, I'm a sucker for the little guy beating the big guy type story, and this is one where it's a lot of heart in that. It's not schmaltzy in any way whatsoever, but it's the little guy and the community coming together to beat the big bad bully, which is, you know, I like that, you know, punch the air sort of moment at the end. That's so, I think that's in its favour. Its heart is definitely in the right place as a movie.
Absolutely. Now, but a couple of things I will mention, because I haven't added any sort of listener contributions for a while. Now, I did put this out on the Facebook page, asking for people's sort of memories and opinions. And I said, Barnaby Sultan saying he'd only seen it once and couldn't remember much, but he did remember Conan the Librarian.
Yeah.
And our mutual friend Ben Baker did contribute, saying he's a huge fan, and he saw Weird Al Yankovic play in Manchester in 2010, where he did a medley of Money for Nothing and Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I've managed to miss seeing Weird Al every time he's been over. And so I'm very jealous. Ben was telling me, in fact, that he has an annual rewatch of this film. And I've probably accidentally, without meaning to, had an annual rewatch of this film as well. Although I held off for a little while, knowing I was going to come on here to really savour it, leave it to the last minute to savour it. But it is rewatchable. And like I say, 97 minutes, it doesn't take long.
I mean, I had the film on iTunes because all my shelf space now is taken up by Peppa Pig. But I saw that you had it on Blu-ray. Are there any good extras on there?
No, it's, me be frank, it's bloody awful, in fact. Which really? Is a shame, because there's a 25th anniversary edition on the American release. But this Blu-ray I discovered today is actually, there's less on it than there is on the DVD I had of it. I thought, I'd get the Blu-ray. I've got a Blu-ray player now, so I'll get the Blu-ray. It doesn't even have a surround sound mix on it, where the DVD does. So it's that and the trailer, you know, like DVDs and used to be.
Yeah.
Special feature trailer.
I had some, I think it might have been one of the Rambo films I had on one of the first DVDs that came out, where it had as a special feature was Animated Menu.
Yeah, that was like anyone was going, no, we'll put the film on in 5 minutes. I just want to watch this same 20-second loop go round and round and round.
Yes. Oh, God, haven't times changed? I don't think this would have come out on Betamax somehow, but I might have to have a look for that before I put
it
out.
I did spot a little Beta reference, though. In the place that they're holding Stanley Spadowski, it's full of boxes labelled up with the Channel 8 logo, the Big Baddie logo. And a lot of the boxes say Beta on them, or Beta. So I like to believe they're full of Betamax tapes.
Oh, what a treasure trove that'd be. God, so it'd be a nice change from plumbing eBay, trying to buy old Betamax tapes for a system. I haven't had a Betamax player for about 35 years.
Hell yeah. Live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Yes, well, my copy of Superman 4 remains untouched and unwatched. People talk about physical media, but here we are. Let's say at least we're not relying on a cable TV station.
No.
Anyway, Paul, thank you for bringing your very vanilla Blu-ray version of this. It was fun to watch it HD. Now, we've talked previously about your podcast on your previous appearance, but for those of us who, obviously I've heard, but for those who didn't hear, tell us about your podcast, Hark the 87th Precinct podcast.
That's it, yeah. So it's a podcast that's dedicated to a specific range of books, which is the 87th Precinct series by Ed McBain, a police procedural series which ran from 1955 to 2006, and there were 55 books in the series, and we've got up to book tomorrow we're recording the episode for book 36, which is called Ice. Very influential series, and it spawned a lot of other stuff, or influenced a lot of stuff, much to the author's chagrin. And and so there's been lots to cover in that, and if anyone's into that sort of thing, then that's where the only place you can get content about that, despite the fact that he was a huge selling author. So You know where to come if you want to learn more about the 87th Precinct.
Well, I mean, when you're saying about the influence, I didn't realise when you talked about it a couple of weeks ago about I had no idea, for example, that the film Ransom sort of evolved from one of his works.
Yeah, so there's a book called King's Ransom in the 60s, which influenced a film by Kurosawa called High and Low, which is a phenomenal film, absolutely brilliant. But it's been the influence because of it's got such a useful plot about someone being kidnapped. It's been the influence for quite a lot of things, whether acknowledged out loud by the producers or just discovered later.
Okay, well, say if you're happy slamming it with Mel Gibson, then there's that one. Or if you want to go highbrow, there's
well,
your man.
I think if anyone can talk me through the world of a Mel Gibson film, I think it could be you.
Well, I've only done one so far, but there's a rich tapestry. But I'm sure he hated Jews back then as well. But
yeah, probably.
Another topic. I'm not covering that one. Anyway, Paul, thank you very much for coming along. As we discussed, this film did not get a UK cinema release back in 1989. As you say, we were spoiled for choice in 1989, and this one sadly missed out. So I can't play a number one song from the time, but what I will do is play the Weird Al Yankovic song, UHF, which will bring out the final credits. So. Don't touch that dial. We got it all on UHF. Kick out your sneakers. Stick around for a while. We got it on UHF. Don't worry about your laundry. Forget about your job. Just crank up the volume and yank up the knob. We got it all. We got it all on UHF. This podcast is brought to you by executive producer Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrill, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger and Alan Viewings, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/BMX Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise and more.